Greetings all, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. I'm feeling a little bit better from that horrible stomach flu that I had. And so this weekend, I'm going to be releasing two episodes to make up for it. This episode, I want to introduce you to Ben Ufana. And Ben tells a little story in the teaser at the beginning of this episode that was very similar to something that happened to me when I was beekeeping. I was seeing a curandera at the time, and I got stung by one of my bees, one of the hazards of the profession when you're a beekeeper, and my arm was very swollen. So I went to go see this woman, and I'd seen her several times, so she knew me, and she said, "Oh, what happened to your arm?" And I explained what had happened, and she just put her hands on my arm, and the swelling I could tell started to go down, but then the next day I woke up and it was gone. And honestly, it usually took me about a week at that point to heal from any sort of bee sting I'd received. So when Ben tells his story in the teaser this week, I could absolutely relate. Now, Ben has had a really interesting life. He had a series of destructive relationships in his mid-20s, and he realized that, you know, like most of us, when we're looking for partnerships or relationships, we kind of look for something that mirrors the destructive or toxic relationships that we had as kids. You know, I am one of those people for sure. This doesn't happen to everyone, but I've seen it happen over and over again with friends that they kind of fall into these traps as well. So Ben then decided to start exploring a wide range of therapeutic interventions. And he trained for a while with Horace Dawkay, who was a traditional Native American doctor or medicine man from the Kiowa tribe. And then after that, he went on to train with a Chinese master, Sifu Li Tai Liang. And Ben incorporates both of these practices in his healing these days. I mean, obviously, he did use these methods of healing to heal his own self, but as well, Ben uses everything that he's learned from these doctors, from these healers, with the work that he does on other people. But yeah, it was a really great conversation, and Ben is a wonderful human being, so I can't wait for you to meet him. So without further ado, let's dive on into my conversation with Ben Ufana.
I'm allergic to bee and wasp stings, and my wrist was swollen pretty badly, as what usually happens if I get a sting. And Horace puts his hand on my wrist, and within minutes, maybe 5 minutes at most, my wrist shrinks down to normal size, no sign of swelling at all. And then Horace takes that swelling into his wrist. His wrist puffs up, you know, it's taking on that swelling. And then I'd say in about 30 minutes or so, he dissipated the swelling in his own wrist. It was gone.
If you had to go to a party or a conference and say, "Hey, this is who I am," and introduce yourself, how would you do that?
Well, there are many different aspects to me. So when it comes to professionally or for work, my background is I spent years training with a traditional Native American doctor, an actual medicine man. And so I work as a healer. Being a conduit, I allow a presence to work through me that facilitates the healing of physical body, the emotional wounding, the traumas that people carry, that enables people to become far more embodied, to be more engaged, to develop the resources so that they could live their best lives. So that's what I do professionally. And but then, you know, aside from that, you know, it's very much like to just experience the world, travel, be in different places, and be amongst different cultures. And there are times, as I said in an article I recently completed, that I like to step outside of what's known or familiar, like times I've been in China or India or Sri Lanka, and I would get as far away from everything I could in terms of Western culture, and sometimes hardly anyone even speaking English, and I would just have to adapt. And that could be fun, living out in villages with people that I'd gotten to be friends with. So I always like to explore. I need that diversity. I get bored if it's always the same old.
Yeah, I think getting out of our comfort zones and kind of viewing the world as a great big adventure is, I know it's essential to my well-being and my mental health. I'm ever so curious, though, when you were a kid, did you even imagine this path for yourself?
From childhood, I had this fascination with Native Americans, just being drawn to Native people. And as I grew into adolescence and hearing about the traditional Native American doctors, the visionary experiences they had, and how they possessed these gifts or powers where they could bring the rain when needed, how there's some that possessed a kind of power where they could be in the midst of the battle and people would be shooting at them and no one could hit them. And of course, those who possessed gifts of healing, facilitating healing that wouldn't otherwise be possible. And so thinking at that age that if ever given the opportunity, this is what I will do with my life. Sometimes I have been a bit hesitant to share some of what I've witnessed or experienced because it's so far outside of the realm of what most people have experienced in our modern day, what I refer to as Wonder Bread culture, because there are ways in which it just feels very devoid of nutrients to me. And yet, when someone would doubt me, I'd say, okay, well, go on Google and just look up Hopi snake dance and look at the photographs of these individuals that, you know, the men would be dancing in the plaza with live rattlesnakes, and the snake could be wrapped around their neck and face and are hanging out of their mouth or from their hands. And so you have these individuals who possess powers and that are so connected to the forces of nature, far beyond the range of what most people in our modern day world would even consider to be humanly possible. But training with this Native American doctor, initially starting, I began to train with him at 20, but later on with a master from China in the internal martial arts. And then I went over to China for a while to train as well. And then spending time in Sri Lanka and India. And I'm always fascinated, even, you know, from adolescence, the things that are paranormal. And so when I hear of individuals that possess these gifts or capabilities, it's like, okay, I want to go check this out. And I want to experience it firsthand, if at all possible. And so I do, whenever and wherever I can.
I have to tell you that I have an affinity for, I mean, I'm devouring recently all these books on shamanic cultures, on shamanic practices. One of my very favorite books I've ever read was Vine Deloria Jr.'s The World We Used to Live In. Have you read that book?
I've read other books by him. He's probably no longer alive, I'm assuming.
Yeah, he's passed. He's,
because, yeah, because I was reading his books back when, as an adolescent. Mm-hmm. And so that's quite a while ago. And he had a book called God is Red.
Yes.
And it was sitting on my desk when I was in high school. And my teacher at the time said, I don't want to see this book in this class. It's probably evangelical Christian or something like that. It probably offended his sensibilities, you know. But anyway, back to a lot of the shamanic stuff, Vine Deloria, I feel, is legitimate. You know, I mean, he wrote some really good books, and I highly recommend anything that he wrote. Conversely, you know, like when I was in my teens and I came across those Carlos Castaneda books, and I was transfixed by them during those years. But I remember when I was training with my mentor, Horace Delca. He was one of the last surviving traditional doctors among the Kiowa tribe. And Horace was extraordinarily powerful and did possess paranormal abilities. Well, as I was training with Horace, I was thinking, wow, this is nothing like anything I read in the Castaneda books. But fortunately, I had enough sense to toss out the fiction that I read from Castaneda. And I had a Yaqui Indian friend years ago, and we were talking one day, and you know, he was expressing some of his frustration about some of the white folks who would approach him, and they were the, all of a sudden they were the authority on Yaqui Indian spirituality, and he would just roll his eyes, and he was like, well, that's nothing like the spirituality we grew up with. He wasn't going to waste his time or energy saying anything more to them. But there are a lot of people that have just kind of concocted, I don't know if maybe they have spent some time, but you know, for instance, you have things like people these days can go through 3-weekend workshops and call themselves master healers, which is absolute nonsense, because usually with becoming a healer, it's a long, arduous process. It involves years of apprenticeship. And just one example, there are different traditions, but my own mentor would transmit portions of his own healing gifts. I mean, again, paranormal abilities. He could actually take like the end of a feather and physically project it into my body, and I'd go into something akin to a seizure. But when you receive that gift or that transmission, you have to earn the right to work with it. And so as expected, you go through the vision quest, which is typically 4 days and nights with no food and no water, alone in the mountains. And it can be brutal to get through that. And those who are truly committed, as I am, will go many, many times. I've gone dozens of times back to the mountain, that 4 days and nights fasting without the food and water. And it's, sometimes it's just excruciating getting through it, but you feel those beings, those forces descend into your body, and you receive different gifts of healing. But you can get some insights. I think it was, what's his name, Plotkin, and he went down to South America. And
Mark.
Yeah, and he spent time with some of the indigenous people down there, and his writing, I feel, was very legitimate. My one concern with some of the South American folks or practitioners down there is that they would play on both sides of the fence. Whereas among the North American tribes, the tribes that I was connected with, there was like, when I was starting out, first they were kind of like shocked, taking aback, maybe a little freaked out, like, oh, here's this white kid who is going into our peyote meetings. He's sitting up all night with us. He's hanging out with our last surviving, the last really powerful medicine man that we have. And he's training with them. He's actually going on vision quest too. And so they would warn me, they'd caution me, say, well, if you're going to do this, you better do it right. Because if you misuse that power, it's going to come back and it's going to hit you really hard. It's going to do some serious damage. And but I've worked with people, for instance, that had spent time in South America and the Amazon and Peru and all, and that some of the individuals who possess power, even though they will use it to heal, sometimes they've also abused it, and they've used it to inflict some serious damage. Seriously hurt some people. And so that's my concern with some of the people down there that can misbehave in ways. Whereas I said, in North America, there's more of a clear dividing line. There were people that took powers and used a more destructive force to harm individuals. And then on this other side here, you have individuals that, you know, they're using the power to facilitate healing within the bodies and minds of others.
thank you for all that. And I just love hearing about that. I really appreciated Vine Deloria Jr.'s book, The World We Used to Live In, because he details multiple instances of paranormal, what we would call paranormal actions or behaviors by medicine men. I'm ever so curious because, you know, I went to seminary and I grew up overseas and I have been to Sri Lanka, if you can believe that. I grew up in Pakistan, so I have familiarity with that part of the world. So I'm really careful about respecting other people's traditions and their knowledge, and that, you know, not all knowledge is for me, right? Not all knowledge, it's not appropriate for me. And that some cultures really, their knowledge and their traditions are their greatest cultural asset. And it's not supposed to be just dispensed willy-nilly to everybody. So I'm so curious, as a young white adolescent male, how did you end up studying under a medicine man?
Again, that fascination from early childhood, which grew, and then hearing about the traditional native doctors, and 15 started saving money and making plans to make my way out of Southeast Texas, and thinking I would go to Arizona, I could get in boarding school and it would keep me out of trouble if I could at least finish high school. But my car died in Oklahoma. And so there I am in that community of Kiowa Indians in southwestern part of the state. And it was a mix there because on one hand, indigenous peoples are peoples that haven't had exposure to alcohol for the millions of years of human history are more prone to developing that chemical dependency, whether it's Australian Aborigines or Tibetans, other groups, Native Americans, of course. So there is a lot of this heavy drinking. It was a very destructive environment and a lot of alcohol-related violence, deaths, all that. And so here I get in there at 17, and I'd made a few friends, you know, from when I was still living in Texas. And so I had that initial connection. And one of my friends says to his father, or the elderly man who had taken him in to raise him, said, "Hey, Dad, Penn wants to go in the peyote meetings." And for some reason, this elderly man, Jack, let me go in, said, "Okay." And some of the other Native elders pushed back and said, "Don't let him." And then Jack said, "Well, this one is different. Let him come in." And I appreciate that. He, you know, sensed that there was something special or unique about me, that he would allow me to come in. And just the fact that I had this affinity to the culture resonated so much, I totally went native. And in those days, I would stay out in the sun as much as I could, attempting to darken myself, and which I can't get that much darker. But I still managed to pass as a half-breed for quite a few people. I built my own feather bustles and had that roach made out of porcupine hair and the eagle feathers. And so I'd be dancing in the powwows. And one guy says to me at one point, you know, the MC of the powwow will call and says, "Okay, you know," announcing the next whatever dancer. And this guy says, "Only full bloods." And I look back and said, "Yeah, I am full blood." And some people would even say to me, like, shake their head, like, "You're more native than we are," because I'd be so immersed. Like I said, I'd be sitting up all night in the peyote meetings and I'd be in the powwows, and it was just so immersed in the culture. I did a similar thing in Sri Lanka too, later on, just live out in the villages and go native. And I think a lot of it was, I just had this natural rapport, and I did get a lot of pushback. There were some people that, you know, they resented me, you know, just because, you know, some maybe just personal jealousy or personal dislike or pettiness or something. But there are others that, because I was friendly and I would just keep engaging with them, kind of ignore their initial hesitancy, and I heard somebody years later who trained in neuro-linguistic programming, and he said something like, just assume rapport, assume that you have rapport with the individual. So maybe I was unknowingly doing that at the time. And so I would somehow make my way through their initial hesitancy or resistance. And then some of these people that normally wouldn't allow outsiders to come into their own POD meetings, they too would make exceptions for me. And yeah, later on, yeah, I'd be back around Native communities, and maybe somebody is suffering from some kind of health-related issue. There's a friend of mine from college, and her mother was quite elderly at the time, and was hanging on by a thread. I mean, she was on the verge of making her exit from the body, and my friend had. And this is after I graduated, and I went to school in Durango, Colorado for the second half of college. And so she is from Isleta Pueblo, and she calls me up and she says, could you come down and work on my mom? And it's like, okay. And so I go down, and this was early in my practice. So I wasn't, now I gather all this information, so I know what I'm going into ahead of time. But so as I'm working with her, and some of these Native people, you know, the veil between worlds is much thinner. there's more of that connection with the other side. And so is this elderly woman's on the table. And I could feel this just tremendous presence in the room. Yeah, it felt like all these people on the other side, like family members that are crossed over, were assisting. And after the session, she sat up and she looks down at her feet. Well, first she says, I feel so light. And she looks at her feet and says, the swelling in my feet has gone down. And then she hops off the massage table I was using to work on, and she's walking back and forth to that little Adobe home. It's like, who taught you this? How did you learn this? And yeah, it was just absolutely dumbfounded that someone who is white, Caucasian, could possess this kind of power to facilitate this healing. And there was an instant where I stopped in a thrift store in Albuquerque, and I started talking with this young girl, you know, who was looking at clothing on the rack. She was standing close by, and somehow, I don't remember all the details of the conversation, but it came out that she's Kiowa. And it's like, oh, I just came back from Oklahoma just now. And, you know, like a day or two before or something. And she said, you should talk to my mother. And so I did. And soon I ended up working with her mother. And the mother was later telling me that the night before she met me, she had this dream, and that she was seeing her aunties, her uncles, her family members that were on the other side, and they were in like a lighted gazebo. And she was walking around and around trying to figure out how to get into the gazebo to see them. And then she encountered one of her aunties who said, it's not your time yet. We just want you to know we're here for you. She said she felt that was an indication from her family members who had passed on that, one, that they were there for her, but also it was signified to her that somehow that her interaction, her work with me was helping her with that connection, and that they were acknowledging it in some way. We're born into our bodies, are, you know, we come from a certain family of origin, and, you know, here I'm Caucasian by birth, obviously, but I don't think that should necessarily limit us. I think we need to be respectful in that if we want to go into one of these traditions, that we do so in ways that are appropriate, and not like some individuals, you know, who maybe spend some time with an Indigenous person or something and figure out a way to commercialize it and go and market it out to large numbers of people and make lots of money. For me, I work as a healer. And yes, I do have to make a living. Of course, I'm going to charge a fee, and I was very ambiguous about that, because traditionally the Native doctors didn't charge a fee, but the way things worked was people would give an offering according to what their means were. But in this day and age, people, that doesn't make sense to people, give an offering. What there's an instance where I, when I was beginning, I was just finishing college at the time, and I'd done work for one man who was sitting at, we went to a restaurant. I worked for one man, and I did work for the girlfriend of another man, and they were all eating. They had ordered dinner, and I didn't have money to eat, and I'm sitting there not eating. They're all eating. I'm going hungry. And so if you don't charge in these days, people won't give you anything. And, you know, in this world, you have to pay rent. You have other living expenses.
Thank you for, I just love listening to you, and you're so interesting, and you're telling so many amazing stories. You know, my second question always is, did you grow up in a religious household? And if so, how did that, I mean, obviously it evolved. How did that happen?
I grew up in an evangelical Christian home or background, and it never felt right to me. It always felt just foreign. If there were certain foods that you just never liked the taste of, like, I don't like the taste of mayonnaise, vanilla, oatmeal. I find them pretty disgusting. And it doesn't matter what anyone would say, or it's like, you know, gross, yucky. It's like, no, I don't like it. And so when I was 10, I was taken to have a little talk with the minister of the church that I was taken to during that time. And the minister is telling me that if I don't accept Jesus as my Lord and Savior, that I'm going to burn in hell for all eternity. So here I'm 10, and I'm given this horror story that, you know, you're going to burn in the fires of hell and suffer this endless torment for all eternity. And at 10, that's pretty horrifying. And through my adolescence, I had these really conflicting feelings. Is it okay if I use a little language here to describe what I was feeling? Do I have to be rated G, or can I use a little
language? No, you can use the language. Use the language.
Okay. So here I was thinking, on one hand, it's like, this is a real fucking asshole of a God that would damn the vast majority of humanity, of his creation, to the fires of hell. And what is this idiocy? If this is an all-knowing God, why would he, you know, put this Adam and Eve in the same garden with this other, you know, this Satan and this fallen angel? And so Eve supposedly eats the forbidden fruit and talks Adam into doing so. And so, oh, so now humanity is damned to, you know, it's inherently sinful. And it just sounded like ridiculous. I mean, just bullshit to me. And for some extent, I went along with it, but it just felt really strange. And being in the church, and some of it's just weird and creepy. And but, you know, it's like, well, I don't want to burn in hell, you know, so go along with it. And but there is always this desire, longing, you know, or I was drawn to the Native American, to the indigenous. I mean, later that expanded, you know, to, you know, that I felt drawn to other ancient traditional practices and cultures as well. But it started with the Native American, and that's still the foundation of my work, you know, and I have continued to go back on the vision quest. What was it? Early April was my 62nd time to go through the vision quest. And again, as I said before, not to impress anyone, it's just, you know, also having trained with a master from China for quite a few years. In these traditions, those who are truly committed will go to But they'll keep doing practice continually. And for me, it's like, well, how much more can I experience? How much deeper, how much further can I go? I want as much as I can of this connection, this connectedness. But as I grew older and began to, here I ended up in Oklahoma and learning from this native doctor, but there is still some of this, like, when you have this messaging that you internalize from the years that you're growing up, and it's like, well, am I going to burn in hell? And so I began to study too the origins of Christianity, from a historical and psychological standpoint. And when I went to college, I studied psychology, also English communications. I was really fascinated with like semantics, the study of language and meaning. But as I delved more and more into the historical aspects of Christianity, and I could see, there were all these aspects like, well, the books of the Bible, like the Bible was assembled, I think Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they were supposedly written something like 100 years after the death of Christ. And so those apostles didn't actually write them. And there was like all of this, they'd be what you considered forgeries, but they were assembled, into said that these were the actual writings of the apostles, which they were not. And I was really fascinated. There's a book I listened to not too long ago called God and Anatomy. So, God is the deity, and then anatomy is in anatomy and physiology, by Francesca Stavra Kapalu, if I pronounce her name right. And it was interesting, fascinating. From a historical standpoint, there's debate whether that Moses was even a legitimate historical figure, whether he really existed or not. They say that there really wasn't any historical evidence stating that the peoples of Israelite tribes, whatever, were in captivity in Egypt, that this was some kind of something that was concocted, and that even the Old Testament, what we know of as the Old Testament, was devised something like about 8 centuries BC, and that there was an idol. You go far enough back, and there was an idol, like in the Hindu pantheon, you have Shiva and Durga and the other gods and goddesses, Vishnu and Krishna and so on. And so within the people of Judea and the Israelite tribes, there is this idol or deity for Yahweh, the Christian God. At that point, it was the God of the Israelite tribes. But there was this movement towards that, oh, God, the supreme deity cannot be seen. And so they did away with the idol. But even in this book, God and Anatomy, which I highly recommend anyone read, and the author is talking about, and I found that other historical scholars are also validating her assertions as well, but that Yahweh was one of 70 siblings. And Yahweh is the son of the supreme god or deity, El, and El's wife, Asura. But within the Hindu pantheon, things get kind of changed around a bit. And so in the early Judaic tradition, that there was Asura was the wife or the female counterpart of Yahweh. So, but there's the images or the statues of El, which again from the Canaanite pantheon, and that was there's some debate as to whether the peoples of Israel were originally an offshoot from the Canaanite peoples. But that religion was practiced in what's referred to as the Levant, which is spreads into, I believe, Syria, in present-day Syria, in Iraq, and over into North Africa, the Levant is Syria and Iraq, but the religions was also practiced over into North Africa, I believe, and those peoples. But all these different groups, you know, like they had their own sort of tribal deities. And so Yahweh was the tribal deity of the people of Judea, the Israelite tribes. And he was more of a storm war god. Each group had its own deity. But, you know, just seeing, reading a lot of the historical literature about the early church. But I highly encourage you to read further, because I think if we're going to believe something, we have a responsibility to really investigate. You know, to believe by faith, it's like, well, I can have faith in anything. I've spent time with people in all these different countries, different religions, different beliefs. And it's like our religion, our belief, it's a filter. One of the filters through which we perceive reality. And because I work with people of all these different cultures, I need to understand their religion or cult or whatever, the spiritual tradition that they adhere to and or buy into, whatever. And so I want to have as much understanding as possible. But if you choose to believe something, I think you should really do your research into its background. What is this about? Where is its origins?
So fascinating. I have to tell you, we have some interesting. I just spent 8 years living in Santa Fe, New Mexico. So you're bringing up Albuquerque and Isla de Pueblo, and I just think to myself, oh my gosh, I know exactly where he's talking about. This is amazing. And I love all these references to all these books, because I'm always wanting to read more and learn more. When I was in seminary, one of the classes that I loved the most was body and sexuality in the Hebrew Bible. And we had to write a paper on that. And I actually went back and wrote a paper on Song of Songs, which is kind of an erotic, semi-erotic passage in the Bible. And I did some further historical research and found earlier songs and poems written for or about Asherah and her lover, El. And it was very clear that parts of Song of Songs had been modeled on these earlier songs and poems for these previous deities. And so all this is so fascinating to me. So thank you for bringing all of it up. It's bringing back great memories of school. I appreciate it. I know our time is sort of getting shorter. So I have to ask the main question of the podcast, which it sounds like you will have plenty to talk about, just based on what we've talked about so far. But the main question is, I would love to hear any stories, it can be plural or story, a story you'd like to share about something magical or mysterious or miraculous that you've experienced or even witnessed in your life. And you can share more than one if you feel like that's appropriate. I'd love to hear whatever you'd like to share.
I think the most magical things that I've experienced would be like from my apprenticeship, you know, with Horace. And again, just it was from the time of my adolescence being drawn to, you know, hearing about these traditional native doctors and wanting so much to go in that direction. And when I first made my way to Oklahoma and I'd be attending these peyote meetings, and there were this native elder, Jack, there happens to be anyone Kiowa who's listening to this broadcast who is old enough to remember, may know him or remember him, but Jack would tell me that when the spirit comes into the peyote meetings, that you'll hear the voice of a woman singing Kiowa. And I was sitting in this one meeting that my mentor ran one night, and we had this cold front come blasting through, And it happens in Oklahoma. Usually it's not that cold, but when you have these fierce winds coming in from the north and the temperature can plummet, and it can stay cold for maybe a week or so. But you know, it's probably down in the teens. And I was hearing this, the voice of this woman in Kiowa, and there's only two women in the teepee that night. And one is Navajo. And of course, she's not going to understand or could not possibly speak or sing in Kiowa. And the other woman who was Kiowa is quite elderly and a woman of that age. And that was the person Horace was actually treating in the teepee that night. And she's not going to sing like that. And I'm just looking around like, where is that coming from? And it's like, oh, it's that voice that Jack was telling me about. The voice of the woman singing in Kiowa, where he was telling me about the spirit coming into the teepee. But there were times too when Horace would be, and you know, indigenous peoples, when they learned English, and they would create their own words. So when in treating their patients, they used the term doctoring, like Horace was doctoring this person or that person. So one of these, quote, doctoring meetings, this was in the beginning when I first got to see Horace work. And Horace would sometimes call like a live mole out of the ground, and he would work with these moles and he set it on the patient, and it was interacting with the patient as part of the healing somehow. And so I would see him do things like this, and that just amazed me. And he would take this mole. Like he had a certain areas, like this elderly man, Jack, he would do a lot of, when he came back to, Horace came back to Oklahoma, they would set up the teepee whenever they were going to conduct a peyote meeting. And Horace would often conduct the meetings at Jack's home. And so there were the mole tunnels around the vicinity of the teepee, but sometimes Horace would say, okay, I'm going to go to this other town, Anadarko, and we'll set up a teepee over there. And he would transport the mole over to Anadarko. And within a matter of days, you know, the mole's like a little industrious little guy or girl, and digging these tunnels. And people are like, don't mess with it. It's his medicine. I remember staying at this man's home, and you know, his lawn, and all of a sudden there's mole tunnels through the lawn. I'm allergic to bee and wasp stings, and my wrist was swollen pretty badly, as what usually happens if I get a sting. And Horace puts his hand on my wrist, and within minutes, maybe 5 minutes at most, my wrist shrinks down to normal size, no sign of swelling at all. And then Horace takes that swelling into his wrist puffs up, you know, it's taking on that swelling. And then I'd say in about 30 minutes or so, he dissipated the swelling in his own wrist, it was gone. So I'd watch Horace do these things, you know, so I was just fascinated too. And I think that word is kind of an understatement. It doesn't really do it justice. You know, again, some people may find it hard to fathom these things. And for a long time, I was hesitant to share a lot of things I experienced. But I think a lot of people consider themselves to be skeptics. But I feel a lot of people confuse the word skeptic or skepticism, because a true skeptic, which I consider myself very skeptical, but a true skeptic is someone who's like, I'm not going to form an opinion either way. I'm going to reserve judgment until I go in there and I investigate this myself. Some things, like if you have a lot of experience, you can tell what's bullshit. you know when something doesn't hold water just because you've had so much experience. if you're very familiar with a certain subject matter, you know what's valid and what's not. But if you, as I said, if you look up like Hopi snake dance, for instance, and you can see photographs of these individuals and with the live rattlesnakes. And so you could see that there were a lot of, that's just one of many examples of how a lot of the native people in times past possessed these gifts of healing. I feel a lot of sadness at the same time, though, because there are very few people practicing on these levels anymore. And so much of it's died out. Many of these people are losing, if they have not already lost their languages, many tribal groups. Now, starting from, the time they were forcing the native people onto reservations, and they were taking the children and shipping them off to boarding schools, and children were verbally, physically, even sexually abused, and they were shamed for their indigenous culture. They were not allowed to speak their traditional native languages. And so the mass collective trauma, for a number of reasons, the genocide that these people were subjected to, the fact that these people were forced off of their ancestral homelands, that the children were taken and subjected to various forms of abuse. And so there's mass collective trauma among the native people. And the fact that not having alcohol over the millions of years, the higher susceptibility to alcoholism, and also those who have experienced a great deal of trauma are more inclined to self-medicate, whether it's alcohol or other substances. And not just among Native Americans, it's in other indigenous groups throughout the world. You know, there's the lure of all the modern conveniences and our distractive technology, smartphones and social media and all that. It's addictive as hell, and it sucks us in. And even in other cultures, it's really difficult for people to have that kind of focus and discipline needed to develop one's bodies and minds, whether it's, among the Buddhist traditions, these disciplines through which one does hours and hours of intensive daily meditation practice, or the Taoist traditions like you find in China, a lot of the internal Qigong practices, Hindu Vedic tradition, their systems of meditation, internal practice, all these systems, it requires a great deal of focus. And we need our minds free of a lot of this distractive technology in order to be able to focus, in order to do the hard work to develop our bodies and minds.
Yeah, and I did interview a gentleman called Louis Mel Madrona, who has written multiple books. And when he was younger, he's Indigenous and Hispanic, spent time in Santa Fe, extended period of time in the desert, Southwest, and he studied with a Cherokee healer. And he said, and he's an MD from Stanford. Mm-hmm. So he marries kind of both of those worlds. And he said one of the things that really kind of distresses him the most is all of this knowledge of these powerful, powerful medicine men and women is being lost. And these ways of being, these ways of interacting and having conversation with the spirit world, with the plant world, with things that we can't even imagine, it's disappearing. And what are we going to do when those modalities, those ways of having conversation with what we cannot see are no longer with us? And so right. he was saying, of course, rightfully so, many Indigenous peoples say, hey, we're not sharing our knowledge, our religion, anything with anybody outside, any white people, Hispanic people, we're not sharing it. But others are saying, if we don't start sharing this and dispensing the knowledge, it's gonna be gone, because so many of our younger people don't want to train and study the way they need to for years and years and years and years. And so there's two camps. Right. There's two camps. And all I could think of was how I don't know how distressing isn't even the word, but how horrific and terrible it would be if that knowledge was lost forever. And so it's like, how do we cultivate that? How do we get out into the world and make sure that we don't lose it so that we can have these relationships with the things that are unseen, that are waiting for us to commune with them, that are waiting to help us heal the world, the plants, the, you know, the air we breathe, other human beings. It's a really challenging question.
Yeah. And a lot of it is going to be lost. You know, it's much of it has already been lost. And there are so many, many, many individuals among the tribes. It was, I think, it varied some according from one tribe to the next. In some tribes, I think just about all the men would go out and do vision quests. And some tribes, I think both men and women would go through, maybe they called it differently, but they would go through these something, a vision quest or something comparable. And there were many individuals that possessed various gifts of one form or another, some kind of power. Some of this was passed down in families, like, you know, from parent to child, or could be from an auntie or uncle or grandparent to a younger family member. And so many different kinds of gifts are powers. You know, so it wasn't all the same, but the fact that there are so few people who practice this sort of thing in our current age. And I think about that because I don't know of anyone among the Kiowa tribe that I lived among that still possesses these gifts. Maybe there are a few individuals may have some things, but not the level of power, not the magnitude that some of these doctors way back there possessed, or not what my mentor Horace possessed. And I know, like a lot of these other tribes, you know, it's just they have the brown skin, they have the, you know, the names that have been passed down through the generations, but a lot of them don't know their languages, and they don't really adhere to these traditions, and their diets are sometimes absolutely horrible. And a lot of these people are really nice and they're intelligent, but they don't have the connection to that. And they lack the discipline too. I'm not saying that as a criticism. It's just most people in all cultures are kind of lax in that department. So yeah, it's being lost. Oh, I do remember another thing that my mentor, there are times where we'd be like traveling in different parts of the country. One example is like being way out in the middle of Nevada. And I would drive a lot of the times for Horace. And at one point he just says, pull over. And he describes a plant and he describes its features. And it's a walk over in this direction, and he'd tell me to pick a handful of this plant that he was wanting me to gather for him. And so I'd gather a handful and I'd come back to the truck and say, is this what you wanted? And he would bundle them up and we'd take off down the road, but you couldn't see them from the road. And yet he knew they were there. He never billed himself as a psychic, but I never have interacted or encountered anyone that, you know, I could be riding with him across country. And much of that time spent in silence, we just ride for hours, hardly saying a word. But every once in a while, yeah, there are times where he would be, it's as though he were just watching a movie and he could see into my past. He'd be talking about events that had occurred. It's like he couldn't hide anything from him. And, you know, at one point getting into an argument with him, and before I could even get the words out of my mouth, he would rebut my arguments. And so it was a mixture of emotion. On one hand, part of me was laughing. The other part was really pissed off and wanted to kill him. But I saw him do that with his wife at one point, and she was obviously blowing a gasket. But he was impervious to her anger at the time. It was just bouncing off of him. It was pretty amazing.
Well, he sounds like a really astounding individual, and someone who had lots of gifts, but used them judiciously and wisely and with humility. Go ahead.
I was going to say it was a mix too, because he possessed tremendous power. And of all the healers I've ever encountered, and whenever I'd hear of a gifted healer, and I've gotten to work with some of these individuals, like say from Brazil and the Philippines. And if any time you have the opportunity to work with a gifted healer, like we all carry emotional wounding, wounding that goes as far back as our childhood. We're dealing with the stresses of our present day lives, and our bodies break down over time. The subtle bodies, what they refer to as the, you know, the aura, the chakras, all that. And they are critically important when it comes to helping to maintain the functions of the organs and systems and all that. But a lot of the stress, a lot of the wear and tear that we go through over the course of our lives, it causes the subtle bodies, the chakras, the layers of the aura, there's some breaking down in the subtle bodies. And, you know, when I work with people, I have people stand in front of me and I scan the body, and I can see sometimes they fail to develop, especially if you have people that maybe they're subjected to neglect or abuse or trauma. So maybe they're dissociated, or sometimes there's damage or disfigurement in the subtle bodies because of the traumas they experienced. There's also, again, the wear and tear, like, going through a breakup or a divorce. If you're stressed out of your mind, wondering how you're going to pay rent, you know, the financial insecurities, you know, resulting from losing your job, and, you know, just working jobs that you absolutely hate, and you're just dealing with that stress. And the fact that most people never learn how to deal with their emotions, you know, or work effectively with their emotions. And so we hold that stress and that emotion within our bodies and stuff. And so there's a lot of breaking down in the subtle bodies. And so as I work with people, we'll go in and it'll repair that damage and stuff. But my mentor, Horace, that I was starting to say earlier, he was the most gifted when it came to treating the physical, people with heart disease and stroke and cancer, and people who, quite a few instances, you know, there's a question whether they would survive or not. Maybe they weren't expected to survive. And they would do this dramatic turnaround, and they're people even to this day who are still alive as a result of Horace's intervention that wouldn't be otherwise. But he didn't understand how to deal with the emotional component. And because he didn't, there were times where he acted out a bit. And this, you see this in a lot of spiritual traditions. And there are a number of the gurus from India, even some Tibetan lamas, that have made their way over to the West. And it's not necessarily they come here to the West. I mean, even in India, you know, it's in times past, he had a more structured society. But in the current time, quite a few of the gurus, it's the drama, the soap operas, the crazy ass dysfunction. A lot of it is because there's the spiritual practice. And it does facilitate the development of your body and mind. But at the same time, if we jump over, if we don't address the emotional wounding, then there's that presence and that power that it's impartial. But our bodies and the emotional wounding that we fail to address, all that emotional residual that we carry within our bodies, it creates a filter through which that presence of the divine or that power filters through. And if we're not doing the groundwork to address our emotional wounding, you know, and just deal with the emotional component of our lives, even just digesting our lived experiences and our subsequent cognitive and emotional responses, then it can distort the expression, our ability to work with this power in these gifts of healing or other spiritual gifts. It could distort our ability to work with them in a healthy and clean way. We could act out and become a bit dysfunctional with it, or even become harmful with it. So that's something my mentor Horace didn't intentionally, it's not something he wanted to teach me. It was his purpose to teach me, but I learned that through example. And also the fact that when he transmitted that medicine, these healing gifts or powers to me, and as I began to work with people individually, after a couple of years of training with Horace, I put myself back in college. I needed to reassemble myself and put my head back together and myself as a whole back together. So it was nice being in college and had a lot of fun during those couple of years. But when it came near to graduation, it's like, oh, college financial aid's running out. I actually have to support myself and I have to work for a living. But as I started working with people and that medicine, that power started to awaken within me, it was like pouring hydrogen peroxide into an infected wound. And so the traumas, the emotional wounding that I carried from childhood and adolescence, all that was just coming out. I was just consumed by all this pain and the crazy ass dysfunction that I was enacting in my attempts at romantic relationships. And so because of that, it compelled me to learn to work effectively with my own emotional responses, to do the deep level processing of my own both lived experiences and emotional responses. There's a meditation practice that I teach. Actually, I developed a whole series, my own system of meditation practices, but I'll describe the most basic of the system, which is acknowledge what's happening in your life. Step one, it could be anything, loss of a job, relationship and turmoil, or maybe the loss of that relationship or the death of a loved one, or it could be anything that you're going through. So one, acknowledge what's happening. Two, what do you feel in response to it? What emotional responses are you having? Is it fear or sadness or anxiety or uncertainty or anger or disappointment, whatever? There's a whole range of pleasant, enjoyable feelings too, but I usually start people with what's labeled negative because that's where most people get stuck because they don't process the unpleasant feelings. So two, what do you feel in response to it? Three, where are these feelings situated in your body? Are they in your chest cavity, down your abdomen, your throat, towards your back? Where are you feeling these emotions? Or get as deep as you can. You're not looking at the emotions. You're not looking at it from the distance. You're being subjective. You're fully immersing yourself in the depths of these feelings and emotions, allowing them to be what they are. You're not sending light to them. You're not trying to breathe them out. You let them be what they are. And you breathe softly and deeply. And you follow the feelings and sensations as they go through their progression. And patience is important here too, because it's a process. It takes time. It requires patience. Now, sometimes if the death of a loved one, or if you're fearing abandonment, or you've gone through a breakup for instance, those feelings could be very slow moving. They don't move quickly or readily, and you may have to come back to them day after day for some time. As you become more and more fully present, as you breathe from the depths of these feelings, it awakens this innate healing intelligence residing within your body and mind. And you start digesting your lived experiences, your subsequent cognitive and emotional responses, and it initiates this much deeper level of processing. It engages the innate healing intelligence residing within your body and mind. So this is critically important, a critically important practice that we incorporate, you know, in whatever healing modalities or practices you're doing, you incorporate this practice and it will enable you to advance that much further.
Being such a gracious guest and being so very cool and sharing all of his magical, mystical stories. I never know what my guests are going to say. And honestly, conversations with people like Ben remind me that there are so many different avenues to healing and that many of them have yet to be discovered by the general population yet. I definitely believe that one size does not fit all, and that different healings are going to work for different people. I have hope someday that healthcare will pay for massage, will pay for acupuncture. I mean, I think in general, doctors all over the world agree that stress is among the number one killers of human beings in the world. And I just think, what would happen if every one of us got a massage every other week or had acupuncture or reflexology? I think it would help with the afflictions that are caused by stress and the health problems that we have in general. If you want to find out more about Ben and the groovy work that he's doing in the world, and maybe even work with Ben yourself, there will be a link in the episode's show notes. I feel like I could talk to him forever because he was just sharing story after story after story after story. And you know me, I can never get enough of magical events, magical happenings, things that are inexplicable. So yes, Ben, what an incredible guest. Please do remember that I'm always looking for ratings and I'm always looking for reviews. So wherever you listen to the podcast, consider writing a little review or leaving a rating. I'm so grateful to all of you that listen and support the podcast. It means so much, you'll never know. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Ben. Be practical while also living in this world of magic and possibility. I really do feel like Ben has 2 feet on the ground. He's very grounded, and he sees the world as it is, with all of its limitations and all of its possibilities. But that doesn't mean that Ben has lost faith or hope in humanity. He's able to look out and see what's going on in the world and know that each of us can contribute in some small way to make this world a more beautiful place, to maybe heal another person, or maybe clear a plot of land of garbage, or whatever that looks like, to show up in this world and make this world a more beautiful place. And I think that's really easier said than done. You know, staying really grounded, staying firmly with your feet on the ground, and then also kind of going out into these mystical places and maybe trying to commune with the spirits or form a connection or conversation with that which we cannot see. And Ben seems to inhabit both worlds really easily. So this week, I'm going to urge you to be like Ben, keep your feet on the ground, while also reaching for the divine, while reaching for the stars, for reaching for the magic in this world. And, you know, I think it's going to take some practice. I think, you know, I don't even think I can do that. But with practice comes perfect, I hope. Thank you so much for listening to this episode, and I'll see you so very soon for another episode of the podcast. Take care, everybody, and have a beautiful, beautiful day. Go.